Welcome to this special spin-off audio program of a satellite CME symposium held at the December 2015 San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with two of the faculty members who participated in the symposium, Drs. Kim Blackwell and Lisa Carey, to discuss the cases that were presented by a community oncologist panel, as well as poll questions given to the audience and the presentations delivered by the faculty. To begin, I met with Dr. Blackwell, and before we started to review the symposium, I asked her if there were any data presented at the San Antonio meeting that she felt were practice-changing, and Dr. Blackwell commented on the CREATE-X study evaluating adjuvant capecitabine in patients with HER2-negative disease who received neoadjuvant chemotherapy and either had positive nodes or residual disease in the breast at surgery.
So I thought the most clinically impactful study presented at this year's San Antonio meeting was a study that examined the role of 8 cycles of capecitabine given at standard doses versus nothing in women who have received preoperative standard chemotherapy and yet still have cancer left over at the time of their surgery. So those patients that do not achieve a complete pathologic response. And so this study really offered some support for what many of us were tempted to do in this patient population anyway, which is, okay, I've given them an anthracycline, I've given them a taxane. Is there any other non-cross-resistant agent that the patient might benefit from if they have cancer left over at the time of their definitive surgery? So what the study demonstrated was that using standard doses of capecitabine, we had already seen data that it's safe to do this and that patients tolerated it fairly well. The data that was presented at this year's meeting showed a significant improvement in both disease-free survival and overall survival for those women who were offered 8 cycles of capecitabine in the adjuvant after neoadjuvant setting.
So yeah, the hazard rate for DFS was 0.70 at 5 years, going from 67.7% to 74.1%. And for survival, the hazard rate was 0.6, going from 83.9 to 89.2%. What was the eligibility criteria of the trial?
So it was a study that was very practical. You didn't have to, you know, have 2.2 centimeters and ER positive, PR negative, and all the fine things. It was open to all subgroups of breast cancer. And even with that, and really with no enrichment strategy other than having residual disease, it showed a benefit. And I believe clinicians should pay attention to this. For women in particular, those patients that have ER negative breast cancer, this is something to be considered.
That's interesting. Well, let's go back through some of the cases and the questions that we discussed during the meeting. As you know, we had 5 community-based oncologists who work with us to come up with cases and questions for the faculty to address. And I want to start out with your module on HER2-positive metastatic disease. And, you know, we talked to Dr. Carolyn Hendricks, who had a bunch of questions and cases that she wanted to present. And the first one, which in a way kind of was kind of basic, but it ended up being a pretty interesting discussion, was a patient she had with metastatic HER2-positive disease where the patient was also estrogen receptor positive. She brought up the issue of, at the end of, you know, sort of the Cleopatra chemo anti-HER approach, do you start out with maintenance or, you know, endocrine therapy or hold off? When we pose that as a question to the audience, almost all the audience as well as the faculty say they routinely follow it by endocrine therapy. Is that your general approach?
Yeah. So again, our role in taking care of metastatic HER2-positive breast cancer is really to minimize toxicity but improve efficacy. And, you know, although the combination of endocrine therapy and anti-HER2 therapy has not been a home run, meaning 1 + 1 = 5, there is an added benefit in terms of progression-free survival when you add trastuzumab to baseline endocrine therapy. So it would make sense that in an ER-positive-driven tumor, once you've stopped the chemotherapy, to add anti-estrogen therapy on top of pertuzumab and trastuzumab. We'll ultimately get an answer about what this triplet activity looks like in a study of ER-positive, HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer, where patients were randomized to treating physicians choice of endocrine therapy and trastuzumab versus treating physician's choice of endocrine therapy plus trastuzumab and pertuzumab. And that's a completed accrual. It is a study that's powered to show a survival benefit for the addition of pertuzumab. And we're expecting the results in late 2016 or early 2017. So, you know, I would be extremely surprised if adding pertuzumab to endocrine therapy and TRAS didn't add something given what we know, but we're awaiting that results. And in the meantime, I would strongly advocate adding endocrine therapy in that situation. There are cases that I would consider using endocrine therapy plus anti-HER2 therapy, but all of the data, even from the earliest studies, suggests that a delay in initiation of anti-HER2 therapy leads to a detriment in survival. So, for instance, the two registration studies, both by Dr. Slaman and the study that looked at docetaxel plus or minus trastuzumab, allowed for crossover. So what happened was patients didn't get the trastuzumab with the chemo, but then when they progressed, they were allowed to receive the trastuzumab. And what we found that is even if you get trastuzumab in the second line setting, there still is survival detriment, suggesting, you know, the trastuzumab was added to the chemo, to a different chemo, suggesting that there's a survival detriment for not getting upfront trastuzumab. So I would be extremely reluctant about not incorporating anti-HER2 therapy. With that said, there are circumstances where I'll employ endocrine therapy plus an anti-HER2 agent. And I frequently, in this setting, will utilize an aromatase inhibitor plus trastuzumab plus lapatinib. And my thinking behind that, and the situations where I'll use that, is where I really believe or know that the tumor is going to be endocrine sensitive. This is de novo. This is not recurrence on endocrine therapy. This is de novo ER-positive breast cancer that primarily is bone predominant, not very symptomatic, and really has the features of what we would expect with endocrine sensitive breast cancer, which is predominantly bone-only disease. So for young women who are working full-time and unfortunately are diagnosed, I'll also incorporate ovarian suppression into that mix. But I feel pretty strongly that if you know a tumor is driven by estrogen and you know a tumor is driven by HER2, like truly not this equivocal or, you know, 3+ and the ratio is, you know, 2.3, but really the ratio comes back 9 and you got bone predominant disease, it makes sense to me to offer HER2 blockade in the setting of anti-estrogen therapy.
So what about the combination of endocrine therapy, trastuzumab, and pertuzumab without chemotherapy?
Yeah, so that I'm not ready to make that leap. Like I said, there is an ongoing study that will look at that combination versus endocrine therapy plus trastuzumab. I think if you're going to utilize pertuzumab in the metastatic setting and claim you're using it or adding it on top of a taxane trastuzumab backbone in order to improve survival, I think you have to kind of stick to chemotherapy, trastuzumab, and pertuzumab.
Another issue that we got into relates to brain mets. As you know, in our conversation with Dr. Hendricks, she brought this up as a major problem. And one of the scenarios, again, that we discussed was the patient who gets started out on a Cleopatra-type approach for metastatic disease has a very good response. We put in this question a clinical complete response. But then during maintenance therapy with trastuzumab, pertuzumab, develops multiple small brain mets. And the question, sort of putting aside whatever you're going to do about the brain locally, what do you do about systemic therapy? And we saw that the most common answer the audience gave was to continue the trastuzumab, pertuzumab, presumably to keep the systemic response going. But almost the same number of people talked about switching to T-DM1. How often do you see this happen and what do you do about it?
Yeah, unfortunately, this is a very common scenario that the patient's doing extremely well, you know, what I say, from the neck down, and then they develop headaches or nausea, vomiting, and unfortunately, you send them for brain imaging, and they've got 3 or 5 brain metastases. And I think, at least in the short term, we have very good symptom relief for these patients with SRS and sometimes whole brain, but most of us are preferring to utilize local regional therapy using SRS. The current ASCO guidelines, which I try very hard to follow on a regular basis, is if the disease systemically is well controlled and the only site of progression is the brain, do not stop what you're doing and just utilize local regional management. However, that's, you know, we're always tempted to just do what else can we do? That's our job as a clinician. And so in general, I will not stop the pertuzumab and the trastuzumab. I will talk to the patient about either adding chemotherapy back in, and that's one of the considerations, or just following the ASCO guidelines and continuing the pertuzumab and trastuzumab alone. When I think about adding chemotherapy, I tend to think about traditional chemotherapies that might be active with HER2-targeted agents and also have some activity in crossing the blood-brain barrier, at least we think. And one of the drugs I frequently will utilize is capecitabine. And a lot of it really depends on how long they responded. Like the patient we discussed, it sounds like she had this really amazing result to the taxane. And so really the decision-making after her brain mets are locally treated, presumably with SRS, the decision for me is, do you just keep the pertuzumab, trastuzumab, or do you throw in some chemo light that might help control the disease within the brain, such as capecitabine? We don't know the answer to this question, but I would discuss both options with patients and see what they have to say.
Dr. Hendricks had another case of a patient with brain mets who was stabilized with T-DM1 for about 2 years, and that brought up another question we discussed, which is what's known about the activity in the brain of T-DM1?
Yeah, so this is really a quickly evolving field. There's been some preclinical models that suggest that in established breast cancer brain metastases, when you utilize trastuzumab, you don't see much anti-cancer activity. But when you utilize T-DM1, you see this pretty potent anti-cancer activity on the brain mets. So that leads me in my common sense way to think maybe the trastuzumab has been crossing the blood-brain barrier all along. It's just not enough to get the brain mets under control. But if you actually use the trastuzumab as a carrier pigeon to get the chemo to the brain mets, you see a pretty tremendous amount of activity. And there have been multiple case series in the past year showing that T-DM1 has demonstrated activity within the brain, some true anti-cancer, and some maybe it's just radiation recall. We don't know. Maybe you're getting a kind of second wave of radiation effects with the T-DM1. There was at least two case series suggesting that. And then we've reviewed the data on the patients who had known but asymptomatic brain mets in the Amelia study. And what we found is even when you look at the patients with known brain mets, there appears to still be a survival benefit for T-DM1 over lapatinib capecitabine, which, you know, if you were just looking at brain met activity, you might have predicted that capecitabine and lapatinib, you might have lost that survival benefit because one's a small molecule inhibitor that can get into the brain. But in fact, the survival benefit persists in those patients that have known brain mets from Amelia. That was just published by Ian Krupp and the rest of us in Annals of Oncology this year.
So one other case that she brought up was a patient with metastatic disease, multiple therapies over time, who at one point had experienced a transient asymptomatic drop in LVEF. And her question was, in general, what kind of monitoring, cardiac monitoring, needs to be done in the metastatic situation?
Well, you know, there was certainly a lot of information, even at this year's meeting, about the cardiac toxicity that we know exists with HER2-targeted agents, primarily trastuzumab. And in the early stage setting, I tend to follow the package guidelines, which is, you know, every 12 weeks you get some type of cardiac evaluation. My experience lately has been the harder you look for a drop in EF, even if it's just a 5% drop, you might find it, especially if you're utilizing sequential cardiac MRIs. So I tend to avoid those simply because I don't know what that means. And we get kind of some weird cardiac diastolic dysfunction readings and some systolic dysfunction, but the EF's preserved. And my cardiology colleagues, you know, think, oh my goodness, there's something going on here. But I'm not going to deny a patient the survival benefit of adjuvant trastuzumab for something that we're seeing on a fancy scan that we don't know what to do with. In the metastatic setting, in the absence of congestive heart failure symptoms, I typically don't diligently monitor the cardiac function. And that's because, again, we know that HER2-targeted agents convey a survival benefit. And in general, I wouldn't hold a HER2-targeted agent for a 10% drop in EF. So I tend to not follow the EFs as closely as I do in the early stage setting.
So we also discussed the issue of adjuvant and neoadjuvant therapy of HER2-positive disease. And we actually started out with a case that, you know, we debated whether or not to even bring up because it seemed so basic, but it actually turned out to have some interesting results, which was we presented a patient, in this case 40 years old, with a 1.5 centimeter ER-negative, HER2-positive, node-negative tumor. And we were curious to see, you know, we've asked the same case the last couple of years about whether the paclitaxel trastuzumab regimen was increasing. And we were kind of surprised this year that it really wasn't increasing that much. Only about a quarter of the audience would use it in that situation. A lot of people would use TCH, but what really surprised me was almost a third of the audience would use an anthracycline and taxane, ACTH. What are your thoughts about the options in this situation?
Yeah, so we got 10-year follow-up from BCIRG006. Dr. Slayman presented the 10-year follow-up. And of all of the adjuvant trastuzumab studies, this is the one that not only do we have kind of what I call the purest data, because very few women who were randomized to the non-trastuzumab arm actually went on to get trastuzumab. So unlike with the two large cooperative group studies in HERA, where we got the results and women who had not been offered trastuzumab actually went on to get it, BCIRG006 was really far along in its development when we had the adjuvant results from the other studies. And so I think it was less than 40 patients, and there were 1,200 roughly patients in each of the three arms in BCIRG006 who were randomized to not receive trastuzumab that went on to get it. So this really is a pure, as the driven snow, you know, one-third of the women did not receive trastuzumab and two-thirds did. And so that makes this study very meaningful. The other thing was is that they continued to follow left ventricular ejection fraction throughout the five-year course in the adjuvant setting. So unlike some of the trastuzumab studies where we did it every 3 months for the year the patient was getting trastuzumab, and then I think there was a 1 year, and then we kind of stopped, there was extensive left ventricular evaluation throughout the 5 years for the majority of the patients. They didn't get everybody, but they made a, you know, really good effort to get it. So that makes the study very important. And what we learned this year is that with 10 years of follow-up, there is absolutely no statistical or mathematical or numerical difference between the use of docetaxel carboplatin trastuzumab in the adjuvant setting versus an adriamycin cytoxin followed by docetaxel trastuzumab. This was really important because we've seen other follow-up in this study where there's a 2% absolute difference in breast cancer-specific survival for the use of an anthracycline. And although it never really reached statistical significance, to my eye, I would say, well, it's 2%, maybe it's a little bit better, and I might incorporate an anthracycline in very high-risk disease. So this presentation at this year's meeting actually changed my practice. I will no longer give an anthracycline in the adjuvant setting, in part because it's no better than the non-anthracycline adjuvant regimen. But also, we saw really the late-term and early-term cardiac effects of giving anthracycline followed by trastuzumab, where women were 4 times more likely to have a significant drop in their left ventricular ejection fraction. So I'm not going to ask my patients to put themselves at risk of cardiac dysfunction when there's absolutely no difference in outcome now with 10 years of follow-up.
You know, the other thing is, and we're really sensitive to this because we do a lot of hematologic CME, oncologic CME, and you know, they had a fair number of acute leukemia cases there also.
Yeah, it was a little weird. I mean, there was, if I remember correctly, though, there was like a blip in the ACTH arm, which almost certainly was the anthracycline, but it was actually, you know, higher than in the non-trastuzumab arm, which I thought was interesting, but the numbers are way too small to, I mean, I think it was like 5 versus 1, if I remember correctly.
So another issue that we talked about in terms of earlier stage disease was neoadjuvant therapy. And Dr. Andy Stiebel had a case of a patient who presented with an ER-negative, HER2-positive tumor that was 2 centimeters on MRI when it was biopsied, with a clinically negative axilla. That introduced the whole topic of neoadjuvant therapy, and particularly in HER2-positive disease, the question of using pertuzumab. Can you talk about what your overall approach is to the neoadjuvant versus adjuvant question of HER2 positive disease?
Yeah, so in general, I try to administer neoadjuvant therapy for HER2 positive breast cancer, and there's many reasons for that. If you know that the patient's going to get chemotherapy and a HER2 targeting agent, then why not just get it out of the way? There's no difference in survival if you give it preoperatively versus postoperatively. But in general, we find that there's delays in getting the patient to the OR. We might be waiting for genetic testing results. So we might be allowing the patient some time to think about the surgical decision-making. So I really don't see a downside for the patient that is going to almost certainly need chemotherapy and a HER2-targeted agent. I think the bigger question is not whether should we give neoadjuvant therapy versus adjuvant therapy. I think the bigger question is how low do you go, meaning how small of tumor do you treat with pertuzumab? How small of tumor do you use 12 weeks of paclitaxel trastuzumab versus TCH versus TCHP? Then that's the question that I think we face almost daily in taking care of these women facing HER2-positive breast cancer. I tend to default to utilizing pertuzumab, and in general, that's because I don't want to deny my patients the benefit of pertuzumab if it exists, given that there is no clinical trial at the current time that they can participate in. And I also tend to incorporate pertuzumab if there is really a need to shrink the tumor, because what we do know about pertuzumab is it significantly improves complete pathologic response rate. At this year's meeting, I thought one of the more impressive presentations was a data set from the Netherlands looking at stage one, which was primarily T1B tumors that had been participated. It was not a prospective study, it was a registry. And they looked at these small tumors that had gotten trastuzumab versus not receiving trastuzumab. And just like we saw with the lymph node negative population of BCIRG006, there was a tremendous benefit to trastuzumab in these smaller tumors, which really, once again, provides us some data that we're making the most impact on survival in these highly curable, small HER2-positive breast cancer by adding trastuzumab. So I extrapolate that if trastuzumab works really well in these smaller tumors, and I've already explained my rationale why I would give it preoperatively, I also extrapolate that I'll incorporate the best HER2-targeted agents, which is pertuzumab and trastuzumab.
So are there any situations where you would use neoadjuvant therapy with chemo and trastuzumab without pertuzumab?
Well, there's a situation like I saw yesterday in clinic. This is a woman who's desiring bilateral mastectomies. She's 46. She has a long history of metastatic papillary thyroid cancer. So her genetic testing is still pending, but she already knows that she wants bilateral mastectomies. That's a very personal choice, but she's quite definitive in that. And in the process of kind of getting that all arranged, and her tumor on imaging is 1.5 centimeters, but the biopsy is ER strongly positive, PR strongly positive, and HER2 3 plus with a FISH ratio of 4.6. And clinically node negative. So she's someone that I offer 12 weeks of paclitaxel and trastuzumab in the neoadjuvant setting too. She has a T1 cancer, very low grade features, but meets all the criteria for benefiting from a HER2 targeted agent. But in general, that's someone, especially because she's ER positive, I won't necessarily incorporate pertuzumab. Anything greater than 2 centimeters, especially if it's ER negative or node positive, then I routinely incorporate pertuzumab.
So a related question is the use of pertuzumab in the adjuvant setting. As you know, with the survey of investigators that we did that turned into a poster there at San Antonio, we found that about half of the medical oncology investigators we surveyed were using pertuzumab outside the label indication in the adjuvant setting. We found almost the same thing in the audience there in San Antonio. Any comments about that question?
Well, it's very interesting because people feel very, very strongly you should or very, very strongly you shouldn't. I'm more moderate about that, which is had I seen the patient in the neoadjuvant setting and I would have incorporated pertuzumab in the neoadjuvant setting, but to no fault of the patient or myself or even their referring physicians, I'm seeing them postoperatively, I will incorporate pertuzumab. And again, that's for really any tumor that's greater than 2 centimeters or node positive.
And is that just during the adjuvant chemo or also, you know, out to a year like with the trastuzumab?
So I tend to do it for a year and concurrent with the trastuzumab. And again, the only patients that I would hesitate to give pertuzumab in the adjuvant setting would be those that were qualified for the ADT study, which is the 12 weeks of paclitaxel trastuzumab that was published recently in the New England Journal of Medicine, where literally the long-term 5-year cure rate was greater than 98%. I don't think pertuzumab will help those patients very much. But for everyone outside of that group, I think there's a potential benefit, and I'm offering it to my patients.
We talked also about a couple of recent data sets of interest. One, and actually Dr. Luca Gianni was on the faculty of this meeting, was the follow-up to the Neosphere study that he recently reported. Can you talk about, first of all, just remind everyone what the Neosphere study was and what this most recent data set showed?
Yeah, so the Neosphere was a randomized phase 2, roughly 400 patients, and it was asking a question of chemo in the neoadjuvant setting, which was a taxane, with either trastuzumab was one arm, chemo and pertuzumab was another arm, no chemo but just trastuzumab and pertuzumab in the third arm, or chemo, pertuzumab, and trastuzumab, or the triplet arm. And what we saw within that study is that the chemo pertuzumab trastuzumab arm led to a higher pathologic complete response rate. And this led to a trend in long-term outcome in terms of progression-free survival. And hopefully this will predict what we expect to see in the AFFINITY study, which is an improvement in outcome, disease-free survival, and hopefully overall survival in the use of pertuzumab in combination with trastuzumab and chemo in the adjuvant setting.
So another data set that we talked about looked at T-DM1 in the neoadjuvant setting. Could you talk about what was seen there?
Yeah, so this was a really interesting, both basic science and clinical science study known as the ADAPT study. And the things that make this study unique is that it's the first neoadjuvant data we have for the use of T-DM1. And second of all, they did sequential biopsies. Literally every 3 weeks, there is a biopsy at week 3 and week 6. And so we will have some very interesting correlative science already being published from the study, really looking at what's happening to these tumors when you treat them with T-DM1. One of the big mysteries about any of the neoadjuvant trials with HER2-targeted agents is they're so effective that frequently we don't get post-treatment samples. So this study was designed to ask the question very early on, what are you seeing when these drugs are administered? So the ADAPT study was T-DM1, and this was all ER-positive stage 2 and 3 breast cancer, I believe. It might have been stage 1 through 3 breast cancer that was HER2-positive and ER-positive. And there were 3 arms to the study. One was T-DM1 alone. One was T-DM1 plus endocrine therapy, and one was trastuzumab plus endocrine therapy. And to make a long story short, the T-DM1 blew the trastuzumab endocrine therapy out of the water. All 3 arms were very well tolerated, but the complete pathologic response rate for either T-DM1 or T-DM1 plus endocrine therapy was close to 45%. That's as good as it gets. I mean, that's what we see with chemotherapy, pertuzumab, trastuzumab. So we had seen this data initially at ASCO. It was updated with longer follow-up and more patients having gone to the OR at this year's San Antonio. And really the only thing besides T-DM1 blowing the endocrine plus trastuzumab therapy out of the water was that at ASCO we had seen about a 5% absolute higher pathologic complete response rate for endocrine therapy added to T-DM1. Now with a little bit more data and I guess follow-up from the patients that still hadn't gone to surgery, there appears to be no benefit to adding endocrine therapy to T-DM1. And this is important because, you know, we've always struggled with should you give endocrine therapy with chemo, should you give it sequentially? And at least in terms of obtaining a complete pathologic response rate, it appears that adding endocrine therapy is no worse, but it's no better in terms of complete pathologic response. And this is important because, as you know, there's an ongoing energy study looking at HER2-targeted agents plus or minus endocrine therapy to really try to help us understand in ER-positive, HER2-positive breast cancer, if you combine endocrine therapy with HER2-targeted agents, is there synergy? And we don't know the answer to that question.
So one other neoadjuvant question that we talked about, we presented a patient who presented with a 3-centimeter primary lesion, ER negative, HER2 positive, but had a small palpable node in the axilla, which was positive on biopsy. We said that the patient got neoadjuvant TCHP, had a complete clinical response, and the question was what to do about the axilla. The audience was a little bit split. Most of the audience would favor a sentinel node biopsy, and then if that were negative, no further surgery on the axilla. But about a quarter of the audience would just go to an axillary dissection because of the, you know, positive node to start with. What are your thoughts about this issue?
Well, this case reminds me that this is an unanswered question. We are tending to back off on surgical management of the axilla, and most of us believe backing off is not going to lead to a detriment in breast cancer survival. So what we tend to do is offer participation in the ENERGY study, which is patients that have known positive axillary lymph nodes prior to receiving neoadjuvant, a biopsy is required, and then basically become clinically negative after neoadjuvant therapy. They get a sentinel lymph node and then are randomized to either a completion dissection or not. For women where that's not an option or that they choose not to participate, the standard of care, in my mind, still remains a completion dissection, but after thorough discussion, some women elect to have a sentinel node biopsy. And if, you know, I always take the position, if it's good enough to be on an arm of a randomized study, then, you know, it's probably not all that bad.
Well, you know, again, getting back to that survey that we did with the poster, you know, half of the people, those 60 investigators were surgeons, and we asked them specifically about this. And it was very interesting that they're just using, you know, post-neoadjuvant sentinel node, and they're not doing the dissection, although it was also interesting that if the sentinel node were positive, they do a dissection as opposed to sort of the post-op Z11 kind of model. But on the other hand, they are doing the sentinel node, which, you know, to me is another justification for neoadjuvant therapy, because essentially what you're seeing here, if you track the logic out, is you should be able to downstage patients, and some of them are going to avoid axillary dissection.
Yeah, and I think we're going to see a migration from, we used to use neoadjuvant therapy for bulky axillary adenopathy to, quote, make the surgeon's job easier to prevent consequences like lymphedema, nerve damage, and range of motion in the shoulder from what would have been a very extensive axillary surgery. I think we're starting to see that people perceive there's a benefit even in the clinical non-bulky lymph nodes in downstaging the axilla in terms of possibly thinking it's reasonable to consider a sentinel lymph node biopsy in those situations where the nodes are clinically negative.
So I want to segue into asking you a couple questions about the management of ER-positive, HER2-negative disease up front, particularly in terms of the use of genomic assays. And sort of to get into this, I again wanted to bring up that survey we did. And another thing that I kind of wasn't exactly expecting, which was there was a substantial minority, around 40% of the investigators who used a genomic assay as part of deciding whether to use neoadjuvant therapy in these patients. Almost all of that was 21 gene recurrence score. What's your take on that?
So I'm one of those people that uses the genomic assay quite frequently, and I think one of the potential harms of using neoadjuvant therapy for ER-positive early-stage breast cancer is you're given chemo with the hopes that you'll shrink the tumor, when in fact it's rare that you melt an ER-positive tumor away. But the bigger harm is you're given chemotherapy to shrink the tumor in a patient that you might not have given chemotherapy at all had you done the genomic predictor postoperatively. So I believe off the core biopsy the results of the genomic predictors, and I frequently will, you know, have patients referred to me by surgeons who come under the pretense of, can you melt this away or can you shrink it a little bit? And the reality is that, can we shrink it? Almost certainly we could shrink it. We could shrink it with endocrine therapy. The question really is, does a patient derive any systemic benefit from chemotherapy? And I think the Oncotype DX or other genomic predictors, I tend to use Oncotype DX, really help in that. I don't want to be giving chemotherapy to patients that I wouldn't give chemotherapy to had they just gone straight to surgery.
A couple of the other cases, and this was Dr. Alan Astro, who is one of the five docs presenting cases that I thought were really interesting. He had a 61-year-old patient, a woman who's actually a musician, who had a 5.5 centimeter node negative infiltrating lobular cancer where the 21 gene recurrence score was low at 6. And his question was, you know, in spite of the tumor size, would you hold off on chemotherapy? Actually, the vast majority of the audience, almost 80%, said yes, they would follow it in spite of the tumor size. And all the faculty also came to the same conclusion. Can you just briefly comment on that?
Yeah, you know, my frequent discussions with patients are nodal status and Oncotype DX are the two drivers in my chemotherapy decision making. ER HER2 are in second place, and the only thing in third place is tumor size. I think in general, historically, we've not done a very good job of really, you know, paring down what the tumor size means. I view the Oncotype DX as the IQ test for the tumor and the lymph nodes as kind of another IQ test for the tumor. Tumor size to me seems like it has a very strong correlation with how long the tumor was there, especially in lobular cancers. So very rarely will I make a chemotherapy decision on tumor size. In fact, that's of the five things that I look at, that's the last thing I look at.
What about histology? I mean, have you seen patients with lobular cancers and high recurrence scores? And if so, do you use chemo?
I have. They tend to be pleomorphic. There tends to be an invasive ductal component that if you look hard enough, there's, you know, a more aggressive looking portion that's typically ER less positive. But again, I tend to believe the Oncotype over the histology again.
The final thing we put in there, we saw actually there was an abstract that was about to be presented looking at some SEER data in terms of the use of genomic markers in that data set. And one of the things that they found that I thought was really interesting, and that's why we put this case together, was it looked like a lot less use in older women. So we put together a case of a 77-year-old lady who'd had a modified radical mastectomy for a 2.2 centimeter ER-positive, HER2-negative, node-negative tumor, you know, kind of situation where a lot of people would certainly use a 21 gene recurrence score in a, you know, 50, 60-year-old patient, but now we're saying age 77. And interestingly, both the faculty and the audience was completely split about whether to do the, in this case, the 21 gene recurrence score or not. How do you think through the situation and, you know, how do you get into this issue of the possibility of chemotherapy in older women? What's the oldest, the age of the oldest woman you've given adjuvant chemotherapy to?
Well, I certainly hope when I'm 77, someone's ordering a genomic assay on my tumor. I hope to be healthy, not have a lot of competing comorbidities. And again, I think the party line here is if the patient has so much concomitant illness that you wouldn't give chemotherapy, don't send the assay. It's a helpful tool, but it shouldn't be driving all decision making. So, but in someone who really doesn't have a lot of life-threatening illnesses, and someone I would give, you know, four cycles of docetaxel cytoxin to, I will send the assay, and then I will use it as an informed decision-making tool with the patient. Age, to me, both young age and old age, does not affect my decision-making. It affects my treatment. So younger women, I tend to be very aggressive with anti-estrogen management. And older women, I think more about toxicity. But in terms of younger versus older women benefiting more or less from chemotherapy, I think all of the data really points to that age is irrelevant in terms of the benefit of chemotherapy for the appropriate patient.
I mean, have you given adjuvant chemotherapy to anybody over age 80?
I have an 82-year-old that had a triple-negative breast cancer, very healthy. In fact, was walking, you know, walking marathons, probably healthier than me, certainly. And, you know, after a discussion, and I think most of us realize that older patients, and this is in the literature, tend to do okay with chemotherapy and tend to at least appreciate being part of the decision-making process as to whether they take it or not. And I certainly have had 82-year-old who basically look at me like I'm crazy if I even talk to them about it. So it's a very individual patient decision.
Well, that's what I was thinking, because we're used to this concept of, you know, individuality and how patients see things. And I mean, it sounds like certainly there are plenty of women who are over 75, as you say, over 80, who, if had the options laid out to them, would be willing to invest their time, et cetera, to receive adjuvant chemotherapy. Is that your experience?
Yeah, sure. I mean, age is just a number for most of my patients.